man. One move on the game board. I'm supposed to tell Rowan, and Rowan is supposed to react. Wade has his profile, and he'll have done his research. Yes, Rowan is smart and brave and skilled in combat, but he has demons that need tending with a few beers down the street and drama with women who come and go and keep him occupied on the phone even as his partner tries to call him a dozen times. We are all human. We all make mistakes. But Wade knows what mistakes Rowan is likely to make, and he's calculated how to use them. Rowan needs to be level-headed. He needs to be careful and patient. So when we do come for Wade, he won't see us. The more personal this case becomes, the more mistakes both of us will make.
Elise!
Rowan sounds concerned now. Sorry. False alarm. I thought I had something, but I was wrong. I ramble about a tip, someone who saw a blue truck and how I went out to find it. It wasn't Wade's, but that's why he heard the sounds from the street.
You went out alone? On a tip from the call line?
Now Rowan is the one who rambles, about how careless that was and how I should have waited until morning. And I argue that the truck might have been gone by then, and why didn't he pick up? He says he had to finish his call, and I always text him, so he was waiting for that. For a text. He didn't think a few minutes would matter. I was home with Mitch, and the detail was outside my house. How could he have known I ditched them? We stop arguing, and I tell him I'm sorry and that I'm heading home now. I'll have to deal with Mitch and the cops who stayed outside the house. They saw me leave and called and left messages and probably reported it back to the department. We get enough tips about blue trucks that I can cover myself there. No one will check. No one will ask which one, and no one knows what street I was on or where I was heading. I drive home slowly, thinking it all through. Rowan will never know, but Wade will assume he does. He will assume I've told him, and that now my partner is filled with rage that will cloud his judgment, make him volatile, make him useless, or perhaps vulnerable. This entire night was meant to compromise my backup, just like the stunt he pulled with Brianna and Mitch had infiltrated my marriage. He is tearing down my life, one brick at a time. But I haven't told Rowan. He hasn't been taken from me. I think that maybe, just maybe, I've shifted the scales again, made a move he didn't see coming, and now I have the advantage. I don't know how to use it. I need to get through what waits for me at home. I need sleep. I need the thoughts to settle and rest so they can find their right places in my mind. Still, I know I'm right about this. The end is near.
Chapter 28. The Kill Room. The woman on the team still doesn't like the notes from the interview with Laurel Hayes' friend in Bridgeport. Her story doesn't add up. The friend's name is Kendra, and she works as a nurse in a pediatrician's office. She and Laurel went to school together. Laurel was studying to be a social worker, which is what she did at Clear Horizons. The phone records for Laurel Hayes go back 2 years. They've already established a close connection through texts and calls, and later many more calls than texts. And the calls suddenly got longer. The woman on the team continues to be suspicious of this change of behavior. Something was going on that required conversations, either because it was serious or because Laurel didn't want to leave a written trail. She's finally cleared to go to Bridgeport to speak with Kendra, which she does, one-on-one at a coffee shop. Plain clothes, concern on her face. She is straight with Kendra, but delivers the message, woman to woman. She gets more of the same. Nothing was wrong. Laurel was just upset about the shooting and having worked with Clay Lucas. Not depressed, but you know, sometimes friends need a little more hand-holding. This was one of those times. So on and so forth. It goes on like that, with the investigator hiding her frustration, until she asks about the man with the red jacket. Did she ever mention a man watching her at work from across the street? He sometimes wore a red jacket. It is so subtle, she thinks, the way Kendra's eyes widen and how a breath rushes in the way it might when you're taken by surprise, which she is. It happens in a split second, that magical moment when a cop knows they've found an opening and has the experience to work it. Now, to be clear, they still aren't sure this man was watching Laurel Hayes at Clear Horizons. The young male investigator spotted the jacket on the surveillance feed and remembered the red jacket from the shelter, so it became a possible thing. From there, they focused on that bench and that man, and saw him several other times, right up until the day Laurel disappeared. Then he disappeared as well. He didn't always wear the red jacket, sometimes a button-down shirt, sometimes a sweater. But the red jacket he did wear was the same style and color as the one at the shelter. He stopped watching the day Laurel Hayes disappeared. The investigator pushes gently. We think he knew her, and she knew him, and that she told you about it during your conversations. Now Kendra looks down into her latte, blushing. Both indications a witness is lying or hiding something. Kendra, this man is still out there. If he was watching her there, he could have been watching her anywhere, which means he could have followed her anywhere. At this point, all Kendra presumably knows is that Laurel is missing. The shelter investigators have not told her about the remains or that they are waiting on dental records to determine if the victim is indeed Laurel Hayes, which means Kendra is presumably still worried about her friend, and now, if this man with the red jacket might be after her. Still, she doesn't speak, though she seems confused and undecided, which means there is something she has to decide, which means she knows something she's not saying. The investigator gives it one last push. When we got her phone records, the carrier told us someone had been accessing her account from a different device. They had the password and her social security number. They were able to see what we saw, which were the calls to your number, which means we aren't the only ones who might be paying you a visit looking for your friend. This, of course, is a lie, but cops are allowed to do that. It's a useful perk. And this time, it is used perfectly. Kendra is pushed right over the edge of her indecision. There was a guy, she begins. They met at a coffee shop. He was handsome and polite, not like the jerks she was meeting online. He said he worked in a building across the street, but Laurel later found out he was lying. He said his name was Fisher Brand. That's a hard name to Google. The friend and investigator both agree. Thousands of entries about the brand name Fisher blanket the screen. He said he worked in insurance, and Laurel had no reason to doubt him. He was staying in a residence hotel because he'd just moved to town. She dated him for about 2 months before she got weirded out. It was too much, too fast. He was talking about their future like it was a done deal. He wanted to see her every night and all weekend. He never met her friends and didn't have any of his own. He was obsessed with his own behavior and how he was being perceived by her. He would bring up conversations from days before, ask if he'd sounded stupid. Every time they were talking, he would study her words and thoughts, and then always have a similar thought or feeling. His stories started to mirror hers. She said she felt like she was dating a ghost, not a real person. She couldn't find anything about his past, and finally, when she went to the place he said he worked, there was no one there by that name. He should have at least used the name of someone on the company directory, Kendra says. She was bound to check sooner or later. She broke it off that same day, about a month before the shooting at Nichols and her disappearance. How did he take it? Kendra shakes her head. Not well. He begged and pleaded, which both women agree is not very attractive. He sent messages to her phone that swung wildly from desperate pleas to threats and vulgar name-calling, bitch, whore, cunt. Kendra says that's when Laurel started calling her, asking for advice, seeking comfort. I told her this guy sounded dangerous, but she thought he would go away. Did he? No. She started seeing him everywhere, outside her apartment, in the grocery store, a few rows away in a parking lot, just far enough that she felt she couldn't go to the police. He never approached her. The investigator notes that he must have known that was enough, what he was doing. He knew he was causing her distress, and this made him feel powerful. He used to text her and tell her how pretty she looked that day, or the night before at some bar. He made sure she knew he was always there, watching her. It was ruining her life. Laurel Hayes never went to the police. She thought it would make things worse, antagonize him. She figured he would move on when he met someone new. Did she ever admit what was happening? Did she understand? Understand what? That he was stalking her. That she was really in danger. Kendra swears she tried to convince her, but Laurel kept hoping. She left town not because of this guy, but because she was terrified the police would link her to Clay Lucas and find out she'd been in touch with him. This man named Fisher Brand was far from her mind. Well, perhaps not, the investigator says, because now she's gone.
Chapter 29. I go home and watch the feed from the hotels on my laptop in the kitchen. Wade had to have gone back to one of them after following Rowan. That would put his arrival anywhere between 11 and midnight, unless he didn't want to risk being seen and slept in the truck. Then he would enter the hotel in the morning when foot traffic picked up. I stare at the screen, but I can't focus. I can't shake the images from last night that linger in my mind. Rowan walking, unaware of the danger right behind him. His need to escape hijacking his judgment. The green light, the sound of the horn behind me, the bat and the arm swinging casually in and out of the frame. Then the screeching tires and the woman yelling. Terror on her face as she holds her arm across the body of her child, protecting her from me, from what I've almost done. I could have died last night. I could have killed two innocent people. I see the cafeteria at my girls' school and the view of the playground from the place where Wade stood, watching them, filming them. I know what I have to do. And now, I have cover to do it. I type a letter to Mitch on the laptop. I use words like space and time to heal. I say there's been a development, a change, and the girls will now be safer in Florida with his mother. Wade won't risk showing his face at an airport to follow Mitch and the girls there. I know this about him now. Mitch's mother lives in a gated community, and Mitch won't let them out of his sight. I say just enough to scare him, God help me, about the man who's infiltrated our lives. I make sure to ask, not tell, to plead, and to do so with words like desperate and terrified. He has to keep our girls safe, and he has to give me some space. I book tickets, email Mitch the itinerary. I print the boarding passes and the letter. I leave them by the coffee maker. I am wrecked as I creep up the stairs and look in on my daughters, my sleeping angels. I don't go to them and kiss them and pull up their covers because it's close to daybreak and they could wake easily now. Instead, I wipe the tears from my eyes and tell myself I have no choice. I'm gone before the sun comes up. I only had time to watch the feed from three of the hotels last night. He didn't return to any of them after leaving Rowan's apartment building. I have to play the odds that he's staying at the fourth. And if he is, he could leave before I get there. So I just go. I tell the detail I'm going to work early. I apologize again for ditching them last night, and they're over it. Or maybe just tired. It doesn't matter as long as they stay put and watch my house until Mitch takes the girls and leaves for Florida. Please make him listen, I think as I drive away. When I turn the corner, I pull over and send Rowan a text. I tell him I need to take some time, and can he please let Aaron know? I tell him this thing with Brianna is too much, and that Mitch is taking the girls on a trip, and I'm going to find someplace safe to rest and think. I don't get specific, but I ask him not to tell Mitch, and that I'll explain more when I see him. He knows how precarious this is, the situation with my marriage, and he won't do anything that could make it worse. He'll cover for me if Mitch calls. As far as the job is concerned, I'm on another leave. As far as Mitch knows, I'm at the job. I don't know how much time this has bought me, but it's the best I can do. I get to the hotel in 20 minutes. It's still dark. I holster my gun, then leave my car behind a grocery store in the area where employees park and deliveries are made. I walk 3 blocks to the bench where I've chained the bike and remove the camera from beneath the seat. I replace the battery. Then I return the camera, make sure it's filming again, and find a place where I can see the entrance to the hotel, but also watch the recording from last night on my laptop. I choose the diner next door, a table with a window that faces the left side of the hotel parking lot. I order a cup of coffee and get to work. I fast forward the recording to the 11:30 mark. Wade was at Rowan's apartment not long before. I don't know exactly when he left, but I know when I got home so I can make a rough deduction. Today, I don't speed up the replay because I also need to watch the hotel. If Wade is in there, I can't let him leave.
Guess what comes next?
The girls come next. My girls. My babies. He hasn't gotten what he wants, and this is his best leverage. The people I love. It makes sense now why he targeted Mitch and Rowan, and I still haven't satisfied his needs. The waitress brings a refill, and I wave her off politely. My insides churn with nervous energy. I can barely finish what's in the cup beside me. The sun is rising, and the sky changes quickly from black to orange. People begin to trickle out next door. I count the time as I watch the recording from last night. I don't let more than 3 seconds pass before turning back to the scene at the hotel. 3 seconds. Then I pause, watch the hotel, return to the screen. 15 minutes in, I see something. It takes every ounce of self-restraint not to keep watching, but I don't allow myself. I count to 3. Watch the hotel, return to the recording. He's on foot. It's him. I know that walk, the gait and the swing of the arms. I know the slouch in his shoulders and the way his knees fold inward. 1, 2, 3. I look back to the entrance and watch a couple with rolling suitcases walk to their car. Back to the screen. A sharp pain passes through my heart, which is not expecting the surge of excitement, but I can't control it. He's there. On the recording, he walks into the hotel and disappears. The camera doesn't film above the first floor, so I don't bother watching for a light to come on in a room. 1, 2, 3. I force my eyes again to look at the hotel. No one comes or goes. Back to the screen. I double the playback now to get through the hours between his arrival and the end of the recording. It takes several minutes. Count to 3. Back to the hotel. Again to the playback. 1, 2, 3. I force a breath all the way in, slow and steady. It struggles against what I so desperately want to do. Run out the door and across the parking lot and into that hotel where this man is holed up, plotting against everyone I love, and, I have to assume, capable of anything now. I get to the end of the recording. He hasn't left. He's still in there. I look again to the entrance, longer this time because the sky has turned blue. Morning is here. I think that Mitch will be up by now, that he's seen my note and started packing the girls and finding a way to tell them that sounds exciting. He'll have to deal with work and the school, but he'll figure it out. He's the boss. He hasn't called or texted, which means he's angry with me or indifferent or something in between. But I can't be distracted. I go back to the image of Wade entering the building last night. I watch backward to see where he comes from, It's not the parking lot of the hotel. He comes from down the street, from the other direction, which means he's parked somewhere else. And that's where he'll go when he leaves again, to whatever vehicle he's driving. The waitress returns.
You all set here?
She asks me.
Yeah, just the check.
I throw down some cash and pack the laptop into my bag. And then I walk quickly out of the diner and across the street. I walk until I'm past the hotel, my eyes never leaving the entrance. Then I cross back over and look for places Wade might park. Again, I remain disciplined, returning my eyes to the hotel every 3 seconds. I keep counting them in my head as I walk in the direction Wade came from and observe. Next to the hotel on the right side is an office building. There's no parking in the back, and the front lot is empty. Beside that is a car wash and then a strip mall. And just like the grocery store where I left my car, the strip mall will have parking behind it. Now comes the choice. The camera is recording the entrance. It's barely 7, and the hotel is still quiet. I take a chance that Wade won't make a move yet. He chose the hotel closest to town, which means there's a greater chance someone will have seen the alerts from our department. It doesn't matter how hard he tries to mask his face. Every alert that we've released describes him as a tall man, 6'5", the one thing he can't hide. I decide that he's still in his room, maybe watching the street from a window, looking for me. So I leave the camera and my view of the entrance and walk quickly past the office building and the car wash and finally to the strip mall. I go to the end before crossing over the front lot. I clear the side of the building and turn the corner and see it. It's unmistakable. The blue truck. Okay. I force myself to breathe. This is harder than I imagined. I check my surroundings. There are a few cars around it. None of these stores will open before 9 or 10, so I don't expect much activity for at least another hour. The truck is in the very back row, which abuts a patch of trees and a small stream. I walk quickly now, lightheaded. It feels like years that this torment has been happening. It feels like a lifetime. I reach the truck and stop. I see now what he's done. The plates are bright orange with dark blue letters. New York State. He swapped out the originals because we've been looking for Connecticut blue and white or a sticker plate taped to the window like he had before. The orange plates stand out. Anyone looking for the blue truck with Connecticut plates would immediately dismiss it. They wouldn't bother to check the driver or anything else about it the way they might if the plates were more similar to Connecticut's. And he's done something else. Added a logo to the side, just like the one he used on the white van that was parked outside my house. He's found a place to have them made. This one says Anytime Repair. There's a website address and a phone number with a New York prefix. Everything ties together. He's here. I found him. It's happening, and I don't know if I'm ready. I step closer and look inside the window. This truck. I think about how I leaned against it on that back road, telling him just enough of my secrets, giving him just enough to infiltrate my life. Laughing and crying and letting him in after I'd pushed away the others who tried to be there. Rowan, Mitch, even my girls, though it kills me to remember. But seeing it now, everything rushes back relentlessly until I drown in the memory of how it felt to be there with him. How I needed it. Fuck, Elise. This is not the time. I think through my plan and convince myself I can see it through. And then I sense someone behind me. I don't turn around. An arm is around my chest, a hand pressed to my face, a cloth covering my mouth and nose. I know the smell that comes from it. Rowan and I had a case years ago. A woman was abducted in a parking lot. All that was left next to her car was a rag soaked in chloroform. I try not to breathe, but of course this is impossible. I try to move from his hold, but like before, he overpowers me. Did I even tell him about that case, with the missing woman and the rag? We found her eventually, buried in the woods behind the killer's house. When he was arrested 5 years later for assault on another woman, his house was sold and the new owners wanted to put in a pool. I remember the smell as I take a breath, the smell from the rag in the evidence box, the smell from the cloth pressed to my face.
Chloroform takes at least 5 minutes to render a person unconscious. In the case of our missing woman, the car was completely isolated. The killer had time.
Wade won't take that chance.
He slips a loose plastic bag over my head to keep the chemicals in the air I'm forced to breathe into my oxygen-deprived lungs, and from there into my blood. This frees up both of his arms so he can place me in the same chokehold he did the last time we met. I feel the pressure against my carotid arteries. And I think, as my mind begins to go dark, that I was right. This is the day it will end. Chapter 30. I'm sick the moment I come to. My stomach is empty, and nothing is expelled when I heave. My head throbs. I open my eyes, and my first thought is that I'm still alive. Panic rushes in next, and I try to free myself. My wrists pull against a plastic zip tie. I try to stand, but my feet are tied as well. Together, but also to something cold and hard. A metal pipe. I am forced in a prone position, lying on my stomach with my arms beneath me. I lift up onto my elbows, then tell myself to stop moving. I'm alone, which means I have time to figure out where I am and what holds me in place, and from there, how I can escape. Pushed from these thoughts is the fact that I have moved to the dreaded second crime scene. And that never ends well. Light washes in through the closed panes of one window. I scan my surroundings and feel an eerie sense of familiarity. I haven't been here before, but this room reminds me of a case our department handled 3 years back, the execution of a drug dealer in one of the odd hunting structures in the backcountry. There is no furniture, just a sink with a small metal shelf on the wall beside it and a hand pump beneath it. I follow the pipe, which snakes across the wall to where I sit. This is why I can't move. My feet are tied to the plumbing that exits to the outside through a small opening. I can feel the cool air seeping in against my calves. Across from me is a closed door. The floor is wood but covered with plastic. I can see the bloodstains that lie beneath, having seeped into the grains over the years. The detectives who worked that case called this the kill room, the place where the hunters field dress the deer they've shot, the place where that drug dealer was executed 3 years ago. And then I remember. Not only did I tell Wade about this case on that back road, I wrote about this case for the college. I uploaded it to the portal. Every detail I was free to disclose. How the hunters use these shelters, and how the large one has a basement with a cremation oven for the deer carcasses. This was an unnecessary fact, but I knew the students would find it fascinating. Anything to keep them engaged. I even wrote about the room with the blood. The kill room. What have I done? I thought if I let him catch me, if I let him take me somewhere alone with no chance of being followed and captured, I could finally put an end to things. But he hasn't brought me to his hotel or on a long drive where we could talk, where he could convince me we should be together. He didn't want to be alone with me so he could be with me. What have I done? I twist my head as far as it will go to look down at the pipe and the wall. I am less than 2 feet from the pump and the sink. And I know if I have the time, I can disconnect the pipe and free my ankles. Then maybe I can find something sharp enough to cut through the plastic. But there is no time. The door opens, and there he is. Wade. He wears the same outfit as last night. Blue jeans, a red jacket, and a white baseball cap. And I remember that the couple leaving earlier that morning wore the same colors. Red, white, and blue, head to toe.
It's a One America convention, Wade says with a smile.
This is how he's been blending in. This is why he chose that hotel.
200 patriots, all in one place. Celebrating America and watching baseball.
Yes, I think. That explains the bat he carried last night. I stare at him like an animal in a cage. I can see myself reflected in his eyes. The satisfaction runs deep. He is calm, nonchalant, high on control. I take a breath and fight to mask the fear in my eyes. I force myself to stop shaking. I have to change the narrative, shift the balance of power. Do you know what's been so surprising? He asks me. I don't respond. He leans against the doorframe and stares at my face, waiting. When he sees my defiance, he shrugs it off. What's surprising is that it's so much easier to be the criminal once you learn the technique. Thinking backward. I needed you to come to me alone when you thought I wasn't expecting you. So I asked myself, how can I let her find me? The rented car, the plastic bag, the little cameras under the bike seats. You've been a busy girl, Elise. I draw a deep breath and let it out slowly. Change the narrative. He has to question himself. He has to feel enough doubt to tap into that place inside him, the same one that made him follow Vera Pratt into the changing room. The damaged little boy. Now a smart girl would have called for backup the moment you saw me walk into the hotel after my stroll downtown. You should have been patient. I see the opening and grab it. How do you know I didn't? I ask him. And for a split second, his face changes. I see a twitch as his confidence is shaken by the emotional fault lines that lie beneath the surface. He's thinking now what he should be. Maybe I baited him. Maybe I lured him out of the hotel where it would have been far too easy for him to hide and then escape. So many rooms, so many corners in the guts of the place. The basement where they prepare the food and wash the sheets. So many people coming and going. His face changes back when he finishes this silent line of questioning. A for effort, he says. Except Rowan is at the station. I called there before we left. And no one followed us here. There's one way in and one way out. I removed the memory cards from the game cameras. There's no live feed. And I checked you for trackers. Not that it would matter. There's no service up here. He's right, of course. But from everything I know about him, the doubt will fester. I shrug. Looks like you've thought of everything. I give it a beat. Let him study my expression. So what's the plan? If you'd wanted to kill me, I'd be dead. I've already felt the fear when you covered my face with the rag and then the plastic bag, and then, nice touch, another chokehold to remind me of the first time you did it. When you couldn't take the fact that I was going back to work. That I would find out what you did to Vera Pratt. His expression is blank now. I haven't seen this one before. This neutral facade. It must be hard to be you, Wade. The sound of that name causes another shift. He smiles and then reaches behind him, pulling out my gun. Is this the same one you used to kill Clay Lucas? He asks. No, I tell him. Of course not. That one went to forensics. I was due anyway, you know, for an upgrade. My tone is defiant, mocking. He examines the firearm, turning it from side to side. He practices the release of the safety, aiming it at the wall with a squinted eye like he's homing in on a target. This is the first time he's held a gun. I can tell by how enamored he is with it, how he strokes it with curiosity and then puts it back inside the jacket pocket. I brought you a present, he says now. Then he leaves. I let myself fall apart, just for a second. A silent cry escapes as my breath becomes shallow and quick. Blood rushes to my head, and I have to drop it between my wrists to keep from passing out. Another dry heave. I need water. My throat is on fire. I hear a door open and close, then shuffling. Then the muted cries of a man. Wade yells at him to shut up. His voice is commanding and urgent, like he's getting excited but also scared, impatient for this to be over. Whatever he's planned, he can't get his head around it. He is not a psychopath. He is not devoid of empathy or emotion. Everything he's done has been a desperate attempt to be liked, to be loved, to feel accepted by us. I settle myself again and get ready for what I am about to see. I imagine Rowan, bound and gagged, being dragged across the floor. And then Mitch. These thoughts come and go in flashes, and before they ignite any more terror, the question is answered. Wade enters, his back coming first through the door as he drags a young man by his underarms. The man writhes, twisting and turning, trying to scream through a strip of black duct tape. His hands are bound behind him with a zip tie. Wade drags him across the room and tosses him against the wall. His feet are also bound, and he fights hard to sit upward. It's then I see his face. The face of the man from under the bridge. The one whose picture was circled in red and left in the package at my door. Left there by Wade after he slipped undetected into my home. The man I told him I would kill. Because he deserved it. Chapter 31. The man he drags into the room is the one Clay Lucas knew from a rehab. The man Clay's parents recognized that horrible day I sat in their living room and felt their pain, their hatred for me. Nix. Billy Brannix. Now it all makes sense. Wade has been hunting for this man, taunting me in between as a distraction. But everything has been about this. This man and this moment, in a place that I wrote in my post, was perfect for killing.
His name is Billy Brannix. He goes by Nix, Wade tells me. But you already know that. He met Clay at a program he was forced to go to as part of a plea deal for selling drugs to minors. A real piece of shit. And then, when Clay beat his mother with that shovel and ran away, he found this piece of shit because he knew where he hung out. Took him 2 days, but he found him. He wasn't too crazy to do that, was he? Part of his brain was thinking straight. Sure, go off your meds, see all kinds of demons and monsters, and beat your mother to a bloody pulp. But when you need a place to crash, some food, some drugs, some booze, you know right where to go. And this piece of shit took him in.
I let him talk so I can think. I let him tell his story of how he found this man, how he took everything I told him about Clay, and then asked the most important question. How did Clay Lucas know about the bridge to begin with? From there, he found out about Nix. Billy Brannix caused the shooting. Because, Wade tells me, it was his gun Clay took from a stash in his apartment. He was living with some guys who knew how to trade them. He was moving up in the world, Wade says sarcastically.
It was painstaking work to find him. But I did, right?
Wade looks at the man and expects a nod. When he doesn't get it, he walks to him and kicks him on the side of his head, knocking him sideways until he falls over. He struggles again to sit up as Wade yells, "Didn't I?" The man nods. I notice then that Wade is wearing hunting boots, and that so am I. My sneakers are gone. He's changed my shoes. I wiggle my toes and can feel that they are at least 4 sizes too big. I could kick them off one at a time, even though laces pull in the sides. The man, too, wears boots. All of them are different makes, different treads. And they look worn. He's read my case about the man who killed his wife, how he wore a different size shoe to throw us off. Shit, I think. This is the kill site. This is part of his plan. Wade begins to pace. The excitement is too much for him now that the moment is here. It's one thing to fantasize. It's another to be living it and breathing it, experiencing it. Our brains react differently. They respond to the presence of other human beings, to our faces and our movements and our voices, muted as they may be, and even to our smells. The fear, perspiration, cologne. I smell it on the man. All of it. Our brains react, too, as our senses take in the surroundings. The room. The feel of the gun. It's true of everything we dream about. A first date. A first kiss. Holding our baby for the first time. Skydiving. Reaching a summit. Jumping in a cold lake on a hot day. Watching the sun rise from a place we've only seen in a picture. Embracing a long-lost friend. Dreams, fantasies, delusions. They generate from a different part of the brain than a present moment or even a memory. A memory can provoke a visceral response, good or bad. And by remembering, we can grow less or more sensitive, depending on if the memory is of joy or trauma. But a dream? A fantasy that's never happened? A delusion about something that is never going to happen? The emotional reaction is imaginary, so we don't recognize it when it becomes real. We can't plan for it, no matter how hard we try. Which is why every single person in Nichols that day was surprised, and why I was surprised at how my training took over in spite of everything else. The training had given me muscle memory, so I knew what to do, but it could not simulate the emotions, the terror. Nothing ever can. Wade is feeling it now. The same reaction he had when Clay Lucas stood before him with that gun, and even before that, when he heard the shots and froze while others ran for safety. I watch him now, knowing he's surprised, and that his surprise was not part of the plan. This is an unstable situation. I watch carefully as it unfolds, and I see the wheels turning inside his head. He seems to get himself together. He takes out a zip tie and walks to the man. He drags him until he sits beside me, then locks him to the same pipe. It's the only one in the room. The only way to keep him from moving. Then he takes out a knife and cuts me away from the pipe, pulling me to my feet. My wrists are still bound in front of me. He grabs hold of my arm and leads me across the room and into the hallway, and then the main part of the structure. It has a door, benches that line the walls, and a counter with stools. It has been cleared out entirely. The windows are all closed. The air is stagnant, putrid, really, as the smell of sweaty men and dead animals lingers. I hear Nick struggling to break free, pulling on the pipes, trying to scream with the gag in his mouth. He is now a captured animal, waiting for the slaughter. But I can't think about him. I have to stay focused. What's the plan? I ask. Wade lets go of my arm and steps away. I don't make a move. I can't overpower him. I can't open the door and try to run, and even if I could, I wouldn't get far. I have to find another escape. He looks at me like he did on that back road, with adoration and longing. Only this time he's nervous, sweating. So he removes his red jacket and hangs it on the back of the door where there are two empty hooks. Then he wipes his brow with his hand and smiles. Well, it's simple. I brought you the gift. The man who put the gun in Clay Lucas's hand. The man who made you a killer. He walks slowly backward to the jacket and pulls out a plastic baggie with small balloons inside. Only they're not balloons. They're latex sacks filled with drugs. It's a common practice for mules, hiding drugs inside their bodies, coming across a border or through airport security. They also work well in drains and toilet basins because water and even human digestive chemicals won't erode them. Nice, huh? Found these on him. He's a real contributor to society. Oxy, guns, you name it. I think I know what's happening here. Do I? Yes, I convince myself. I think about this structure, things I can use, things I learned 3 years ago on the case with the kill room. What am I supposed to do with this gift? I buy time while I think. Think. Do you remember when we spoke about how much we hated them? The people who put that gun in Clay's hands? You even said you wanted them dead. I remember thinking that many times, though I don't remember everything we said that day. Everything we've texted since. It doesn't matter. It's true, and he knows it. Well, there can't be justice here, Elise, because the gun had no markings, and this punk can't be tied to it, even though I have his confession. They'll say it was coerced. But how else are confessions made? You know that. Still, it won't hold up. And then what? He'll get a few years for something? Maybe they'll find more drugs at his place over the border in New York? And they'll get jurisdiction, but those jurors won't give a shit about our little department store shooting. Do I need to go on? I shake my head. So there can't be justice, but there can be payback, right here and right now. He takes my gun from his pocket and looks at it again like it's the key to the cage that imprisons him. And while he does this, I remember the rifle under the counter from the case here, the execution 3 years before. I remember how the hunter from upstate left it on a mount, loaded, perhaps, ready for the next season, because his wife wouldn't allow it in the house and because he thought no one knew about it, and the ones who did would never touch it because that's part of their code. Forensics removed it, cleared it, then returned the rifle to the owner. Our department issued a warning. But these guys do what they want. I pray that's still true, that the hunters are creatures of habit with no regard for authority. I didn't write about the gun in my post to the students because it wasn't public information. It would have been so different if you hadn't turned on me that day we first met. But maybe all of this had to happen for you to finally understand. I slowly sweep my arms against the underside of the counter. I stop when I feel something metal, the edge of the gun mount. I trace it with my fingers and search for the hunting rifle. I can make out the shape. I find the barrel and the trigger. It's there. The rifle is there. I think now that zip ties can be broken. We learned this in our training because we use them in the field sometimes. We carry them because they're lighter than handcuffs, and there could be, even for me and Rowan, a situation where we had to make an arrest during an interview. So we got the training, just like I was taught to fire my weapon, even though I hadn't drawn it once in 12 years until that day that changed my life. Wade tells me next about filming Rowan as he walked home last night. If I'm being honest, your partner surprised me. He was so careless. I had underestimated the power of his dysfunction, the demons from the war. He lost himself so easily in those beers and that woman on the phone. He walks to the other side of the counter so we can stand face to face. I'm now flush against the edge, and just beneath it is the gun with the mount. I sit on a stool and let my arms slowly drift beneath the counter. I feel for the metal, then for an edge. And the girls. I would like to tell you that I was sorry about that, but they never knew a thing. They were running around and playing. I wasn't going to hurt them. I was never going to do that. That would make me a monster. Did you think I would? I shake my head and say, I didn't know, Wade. Honestly, I didn't know what you were up to. And then that drive-by at the diner and Brianna's tires, that word you carved into her car door. Wade nods and sighs. But it's from nerves releasing the tension that builds now as he finally gets to tell me the stories he's rehearsed for days, weeks. And as he gets closer to the end of his plan, I still don't understand. Not entirely. I didn't make your husband go there, but I knew he would. I'm so sorry about that. Really, I know how painful that must have been. But aren't you glad you know? We cover his break-in at my house, which he says technically wasn't a break-in because I'd left the front door unlocked. And then the photos. And finally, my visit to the Lucas family. I pretend to cough. Not once, but over and over, a spell from the chloroform. Wade gets up, looks around for a sink, but there isn't one in this room. While he's turned and my body is heaving, I break the zip tie with a quick, forceful motion against the metal of the gun mount. I feel it fall to the floor and kick it beneath the counter. My hands are free when he turns around again. Sorry, no water. I get a hold of myself and the fake coughing spell. Wade continues with his story. It got a little dicey there. I thought for sure you'd find me sooner. I didn't count on you watching all the hotels. I thought you'd pick the closest one right away, so I had to move things along. Make you think I'd go after your kids again.
Yes, I say, interrupting him now.
I feel for the hunting rifle with my fingers, finding the release of the mount.
I didn't know what was going on with you. I can see now that you haven't lost your mind, that you would never hurt any of us. I can see that this is about payback, like you said, for what Billy Brannix did to us by putting that gun in Clay's hand.
He smiles widely. Yes! Yes, exactly! I knew you'd understand once I got you here. And this, he says, sweeping his arms around him, his eyes taking in the room. You wrote about this place, and how it has a cremation oven. And you said in your class notes, do you remember what you said? About the perfect murder?
First, you burn the body, I tell him.
His face settles down and he draws a breath. Right. I signed up for a feminist studies course and got access to the entire portal. It was so easy to find your class and what you posted after. You said this was the perfect kill site. Don't you see? I did everything exactly right. The kill room, the cremation oven. You were just as excited writing about this place as I was to read it. His face softens, relaxes.
We are back by the blue truck, out on that deserted road. I'm here with him, alone. The delusion is, right now, a reality. We are together, connected by our hatred for the man in the other room, who is the only one left to blame for what happened at Nichols, who is still alive. So, what now? I ask. Are you going to kill him and cremate the body? He walks closer and leans over the counter. I hold the rifle in the palms of my hands beneath it and pray he doesn't notice that I haven't moved since I sat down, that my arms remain hidden beneath the wood. My life has changed, Elise. I have nothing to go back to. I have to leave. And so do you. I've been waiting for you to see, to understand. Your life has changed after killing that poor, sick young man. You know now about that woman in the dressing room, how I didn't see Clay Lucas fall, how I wasn't in the line of fire when you killed him. The guilt will never leave. There's nothing left for you. I feel the hunting rifle with my hand, finding the safety and the trigger, visualizing it in my mind. I don't let my eyes leave his. I don't let his words get inside my head. When you wrote, "They don't deserve you," that's what you meant, right? That I'm damaged now. That I can't be a wife and mother and partner. That they're better off without me. He nods and smiles. Do you know the expression, burn the boats? Yes, I tell him. When explorers discovered a new land and they knew it would be hard to stay, they would burn their boats so they had no choice. So their crew had no choice. There is no going back when you burn the boats.
Precisely, he says.
I stop breathing when I hear him finish his thought.
So I'm not the one who's going to kill Billy Brannix. You are.
Chapter 32. I am reeling now, fighting to hold my thoughts in place, fighting even harder to find a response. You want me to kill this man? This young man? This boy? With my own gun?
Yes. And then you can never go back to your old life. You'll have to come with me and start over. It will be your bullet they find in the body. Your perfect murder posted for the world to see.
He waves his hands around the room like he's presenting his case.
It won't take long for them to figure it out, and then you will be prosecuted and sent to jail. Dishonored, loathed by your children and your husband. Rowan will be ashamed. Or you can start over, the way I have to.
There it is, the reveal of his plan. How he deluded himself into believing he could have what he wanted, this connection with me. Some kind of future where we lived in mutual acknowledgement that we are one and the same, a way for him to feel accepted and to not be alone. Not for one more day.
You've been trying to be someone you're not, and I'm going to save you. Don't you want to do it? Don't you want this man dead? He asks me.
Yes, of course I want that. Rage has been coursing through me since the Nichols shooting. It seeps out at every target it can find. The man who put the gun in Clay's hands. The woman who slept with my husband. The system that failed the Lucas family. Hospitals and schools. His mother, who didn't make sure he took his meds. His father, who didn't fight hard enough to have him committed. Who clung to the belief that they could care for him at home. Who didn't want to lose his child. And then Mitch, for showing me what I'm capable of. And Rowan, for giving in to his demons. And even my girls, for wanting pink towels. It's not rational, where it flows. This rage, after it's done feasting on the first course, which is always... always. Myself.
Fuck, Elise. Pull yourself together.
I wrap my hands around the rifle. Okay, I tell him. I'll do it. But I can't leave my family. You can leave. Find another place to start over. You've gotten very good at hiding. I can see that. You've been masterful, surpassing anything I could have taught you.
Wade is again taken aback by the change in my demeanor. He watches me now as I go on.
The boots, I say, bought at different locations? The treads sanded down?
He nods cautiously. And the zip ties, the chloroform,
The plastic sheeting on the floor? He repeats the gesture. I presume you were careful picking up this Brannix kid, however you managed that. He's not as small as I am. Was he high on something? Is that when you did it? He smells bad, like you've had him for a couple of days. He looks dehydrated.
I told you, I was expecting you to find me sooner, he offers in defense. I thought you'd be smarter, that you'd call the hotels and find out about the conference and know that would be the perfect location.
I haven't been myself.
He looks remorseful, like he didn't mean to cause this fallout. But there is always fallout.
I continue. The plastic will melt in the oven. The body will burn. I can do the kill so it's through and through. That way I won't have to worry about letting the body cool and searching for the bullet in a pile of ash and bone. I can't go with you. I can't burn the boats. But we will always be connected by this. You will always have this piece of me, and that has to be enough.
Wade is silent now,